I was already in ministry, and I was here visiting, and we were, my family and I, my dad, my mom, I don't know if Colleen was here or not, but I think you were. Anyway, we were leaving the service, and we were just stepping out the front door, and there was a car leaving, and the man in the back seat waved. And I had no idea who he was, but I waved back. And so I said to my dad, I said, who was that guy? And so we had a little interesting story. It was interesting because that morning I had actually spoke here, and I'd sung a song. I have no idea what I said or what I sung, but that's of no interest at this point. But I just remember doing that. In fact, the entire service was in English, as it should be. But my dad said this man was Russian. And he'd come over here because his family, or at least part of his family, had just emigrated here. So here they were, and it was amazing to me that he couldn't speak a word of English, but he was really happy to somehow see me and say goodbye. So I got talking to Dad about this fella, and I was amazed because he could not understand a word that was said in the service, and yet he seemed to be so excited. And why? He came from Russia. He was a lay pastor there. And he'd been thrown in jail a number of times for preaching the gospel. He could not believe the freedom we had to worship. It was very different. Now, maybe some of you, maybe Uncle Harvey or someone else remembers who that was. I don't remember. Maybe it was the Zabirans?
Nikolai's dad, possibly.
Ah, well, there you go. I never did meet the man, but Dad talked with him. My father talked with him through an interpreter. And this is one of the things he said. He said, Canada needs a little bit of Khrushchev.
It's coming.
Persecution. He said it would do the church good. And I think he's right on. Would you turn in your Bibles to Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 to 11. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt at all by the second death. The city of Smyrna, which we're going to look at tonight, is kind of an interesting history. And I'm going to share just a tidbit of the history because it really helps us understand what's been written here. Smyrna, about 600 BC, was taken over and literally destroyed. And it lay in ruins for about 300 years. In 290 BC, it was actually totally rebuilt by a Greek man by the name of Lysimachus. And it literally became a Greek city because he was Greek. He rebuilt it. And that city still exists today. If you went over to modern-day Turkey, it would be the city called Izmir. I don't know if any of you have been there. Pull it up and just Google it and look at the city. It's quite pretty. Well, Smyrna was very carefully planned and a very carefully built city. It was very beautiful, and it was called the pride and the glory of Asia. In fact, it was quite the cultural center of that day. Now remember, if you looked at, remember this map from last night, and you see where Smyrna is, it is like Ephesus, right on the very coast. So it's a port city. And if you looked at Izmir, Turkey, it's got a beautiful harbor and an inlet. And you see a little bit on the map here, but it's really quite a beautiful place. This city back then was very well planned and had become a very wonderful cultural center. Very wealthy city. Remember I told you all of this whole area and all of these cities and churches where the churches were? Lots of money, lots of wealth. This was the hub. A road coming north and south and two roads going east and west come from Europe. And the Romans designed it this way. It was the gateway to Europe, to the Middle East, to Africa, and to far Asia. And so they set up headquarters here, politically, economically, everything. It was a wonderful, wonderful city. A western port. In fact, the vast amount of trade came right through this city. Lots of it came through Ephesus as well, but definitely through this city. And what's interesting is it had, and it still does today, it has a wonderful climate. Now, if you're in Turkey, you know how hot and dry it can be. But in this city, because of the port and the westerly wind that blows off the Aegean Sea, that wind can bring in kind of a coolness, and it comes right in through the port up into the city, and it cools the city down. So it's an attractive city, it's a wonderful place to be, and it's got great temperatures. So it's a place you kind of want to be if you're looking for a place to live, especially now in our climate. But down the center of the city, you would see a plethora of temples. Now, they worshipped a myriad of gods. Of course, that was the Greeks as well as the Romans. They had some formidable gods like Zeus. Artemis was from Ephesus, that goddess Artemis. You find that in the book of Acts if you read it. There were other gods, but there were variety of gods that they worshipped, including the emperor himself. There was a temple to him. And interestingly enough, it was this particular city known as the Glory and Pride of Asia. Back in 26 AD, not long after Christ and his death and resurrection, this city was given the privilege that no other city on the planet had been given, the privilege of building a temple in honor of the Roman emperor. I think Tiberius back at that point. But as I said last night, the emperor worship became much more stringent, and you had to comply with the rules. So this church suffered greatly. I want us to look at verse 8 and just kind of look at how Jesus addresses this particular church. These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. It seems that with each of these letters that Jesus addresses, you will find that he addresses the church by a different name and title every time. It's almost as if that name and title is meant to encourage them right where they are. And I would say if you studied it, you'll find out a connection between the name and the title and what they're going through. And we'll see that tonight. It's almost as if he wants to encourage them, or in some cases, rebuke them and remind them, hey, this is who I am. You better mind me. So it's one or the other for the churches that he's writing to. If you've never done a study on all of the different titles and names of Jesus, there's about 250. It's quite a study, and it would really open your eyes, think a little bit wider to see, you know, who our Jesus really is. It's pretty amazing. Well, here he says he's the first and the last, the beginning and the end, the Alpha and Omega, the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet, Alpha and Omega. And he says, I was dead, but I'm alive. Now, you can't say that about any other religious leader, can you? When you talk about Buddha, well, he's dead and he's gone. He was alive, but he's dead. That's it. You could talk about Muhammad. Muhammad lived, but he's dead. You could talk about Mary Eddie Baker or any other religious leader with a cult or any religion. They lived, but they're gone. But Jesus said, I lived, I died, I'm alive. That's what separates us from all other religions. our leader, is alive. He is God. Now he says in verse 9, as we look at the approval, and by the way, this is one of those churches, Philadelphia is the other one, that has no accusation. They're completely approved. So here's the approval. He says, I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. It's not only that Jesus knows, but the idea of the language here is that he knows because he's been there. He walked this earth. He lived in poverty. Remember, he said, I have no place to lay my head. I've been kind of almost feeling something of that the last 4 years. But we have a place to put our head. He had no place to call home. He wandered. And people cared for him. It wasn't they didn't. But he also lived in poverty. So he's saying, I understand where you're at. I know where you are. And I understand what you're going through. And he understands what you and I are going through. I think there are times in our lives when we think, where is God? I've been through those times. I remember when I was out of ministry for a time, just when I got out of ministry, and I struggled physically for quite a while. I wondered, where is God in all this? I know people who've gone through times, difficult times, and they get angry with God. And God can handle our anger, and he can handle our abruptness. But it's different when we say, I'm angry with God because he's not answering my prayer the way I want him to. So therefore, he must not care, and I'm leaving. I'm walking on. It was interesting, dare I say any of this, but I won't say too much. My wife might be horrified if I do. But you know, our daughter's been going through a very difficult time, and it's very interesting because my wife was on FaceTime with her today. She lives in Airdrie. And they're talking, and she said, Dad, thanks for the email you gave me. I said, email? What email? Well, she said it was a really nice letter. She said, I've been so depressed and so down the last couple of days, and I got this email today, and it was just the right time. I said, really? Yeah. And so then she starts talking about this email. 7 years ago, when we were up north, her husband Josh had gone south, and they were there with us for a couple more months till he got settled in Airdrie. And so finally after two, and they stayed with us, and of course Balin would have been about two at that time, I think. But our first grandchild and our daughter's leaving, and it was kind of a difficult time. And so when they left, I wrote this email, quite a lengthy email, just expressing my feelings of love. She got that email today, 7 years later. Now you got to think, what is up with that? But while I've been preparing these messages, just the other day, 2 days ago, Brother Trevor hooked me up to the internet because I got my old computer, my old laptop, down in the basement there in one of the rooms. And so he hooked me up, and I used the email system on it. And lo and behold, this email was never sent, and it was still sitting there in the outbox, but it had never been sent. It went today. Isn't that amazing? And here I thought 7 years ago she got it. Well, she said, as she replied to me on this email, she said, Dad, I'm very angry at times with God, and I'm trying to work through it. And she's been struggling. And I know what it is to struggle, and I see my daughter struggling, and I see others struggling. Listen, God can handle our struggle, and he can even handle some anger at times. But don't give up on God. Sin is not God's fault. The problems in life are not God's fault. He wanted something far different for us. But whatever we're going through is a time for us to draw near to Him. And He says, I know. I know exactly what you're going through because I've walked that road myself. So you can trust Him. Now, getting back to the church, one of the reasons that they were poor is that you needed to belong to a trade guild. And the Christians were poor. Now, what's a trade guild? Kind of a cross between a chamber of commerce and a trade union. And you had to belong to that. You say, well, what's the problem with belonging to a trade union or a trade guild? Or even a chamber of commerce? What's the problem with that? The only problem was, in those days, once a month, they had this get-together. And before the meal, they would offer sacrifices to idols. So idolatry. And after the meal, they'd bring in the prostitutes. So, what does a Christian do? Do you come to the meal late and leave early? Because you've got to be a member. And people participated. So the bottom line is, they couldn't be part of it. And these people were poor. In fact, the word here in the original languages, they were literally the poorest of the poor. They were beggars. And here they were. Some of us are poor, but sometimes my own fault. But they were poor not because of their own fault, but because they couldn't participate in a culture that was so opposed to the things of Christ. And so here they were. Now, not only were they beggars, they were slandered by Jews. Not only they were persecuted economically, but they were slandered by Jews. In those days, in the Roman Empire, your synagogue or your church had to be registered. Your temple had to be registered with the government. We understand that because our church here, your church here, is registered for financial reasons and other reasons. And it was no different then. So the Jews, the original Jews and their synagogue were registered underneath the government, and the government simply permitted them to do whatever they wanted to do in terms of their religion of Judaism. But the new Jews coming in who had committed their lives to Christ had really changed. And then they were inviting these others to come in known as Gentiles. Well, these original Jews didn't like that at all. So you can see the uproar. So they immediately went to the government and they said, these people aren't really Jews. They're something else, but they're not really Jews. And so they exposed them in a way they didn't need to expose them. And so they were slandered by Jews, persecuted by the culture around them. It's interesting that all their troubles were from the outside. You know, you show me a church that's being persecuted today, and I'll show you a church that almost rarely has issues on the inside of the church. In fact, they're growing at a rate that we can't even imagine. They're stronger than we can even imagine. But when you become complacent, like the Church of Ephesus, you have issues on the inside. Every culture, every church, every country that's ever been on the planet generally, eventually, rots from the inside out. It's not usually the outside pressure that creates the problems. It's usually the issues that arise on the inside because of complacency or lukewarmness or whatever it is. Now notice something here, because in our culture, what do we do when we're up against it? Do you know what we want to do? We say, Lord, I need your help. Get me out of this. And that's what we do. Whatever the issue is, we're looking to get out of the solution, out of the problem, and find solution as quickly as possible. I want you to notice here as you go through this, Jesus does not offer them practical solutions to get out of their problem. It's just the opposite. He says, you know what? I know you're being persecuted, but you need to know that some of you are actually going to end up in jail. And some of you are going to have to die for your faith. But if you'll just overcome. Now, how encouraging would that be if we heard that? I sometimes wonder, but we're so comfortable. It is interesting if you look at the name of Smyrna. It comes from the word myrrh. Where do we get that from? Where do you know that from?
Wise men.
Pardon me?
The wise men.
Yeah, exactly. It was one of the gifts that was brought by the wise men to Jesus when he was born. And you've probably done study, and I'm probably not sharing much that's new with you at this point, but myrrh was one of those ingredients in holy anointing oil and was one of the perfumes that was used for the burial of bodies. They would literally pour the perfume over the body. Its fragrance, now this is interesting, its fragrance was at its best when it was crushed. So the greater fragrance of that product came out when it was crushed. So these people are undergoing afflictions, hardships, it says. And the word here means crushing pressure. So here's Smyrna, that really means myrrh, that if you crush it, its fragrance comes out more than if you don't. And here this church, in the middle of this corrupt culture, is being persecuted, and their fragrance is coming out. It's the fragrance of Jesus Christ. And Jesus' challenge to them is this: don't be afraid. Do you know 366 times in the Bible where it tells us, don't be afraid? That's one for every day of the year, and one for leap year. It's amazing. I am always amazed when I look around me and talk to people, Christians, at how many people are anxious. They have anxiety attacks. They have fear, and they're overcome. And these are real problems. But Jesus' advice is don't fear. Now, he's not saying don't fear about all of life, but when you're in that situation, whatever it is, don't fear that situation. I'm with you. That's the key. I'm with you. So their spiritual fragrance seemed to be at best when they were in the midst of persecution, and I think that's really no different for you or I when we're in the midst of difficulties. Now, the challenge of Christ to not be afraid was only supposed to be for this short time of persecution. And they had a really key leader in that church for about 50 years. His name was Polycarp, and he was actually a disciple of John. Polycarp, the Roman government wanted to kill him. They persecuted the church, and they said, we want to get rid of that guy because he's too important a person in that congregation. So the congregation, knowing this and heard it, they took him out to a farmyard and hid him. But someone from the church apparently did not like Polycarp for whatever reason, didn't appreciate his ministry, and turned him in. So the Romans got him, brought him back to the city, and they're going to execute him. But they gave him one last chance. And the commander looked at him and said, I will give you one last chance to recant of your faith and to bow down and say, Caesar is Lord. And Polycarp said, for 86 years, I have served my Lord. And never once has he wronged me. I cannot do this and blaspheme him now. And they tied him to a cross, put the kindling underneath him, and lit it on fire. But before they lit it, normally they would nail that person to the cross because they didn't want them trying to get loose and getting away. And he said to them, don't bother. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here. And they left him. Well, do you remember that? And then they lit the fire and it started to go. You remember that wind that I told you comes off from the west and comes through the city? Well, it did that day. And in fact, it blew the flame to the side and it didn't touch him. And the commander was so angry, he said, unbound him and take him over here. And he said, kill him with a sword. And that day, Polycarp died. But very much alive today with the Lord. Well, here was one of their key people that had died. And they had to see this. But they needed to remain faithful. If they remain faithful, they receive the crown of life. If they overcome, the second death will not hurt them. I'm reminded of what Jesus said to his disciples. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Do you know, most of what we understand about hell, we get from Jesus and from his lips. Just read your New Testament. And everything he shared, except for on two occasions, everything he shared about hell, he shared with his disciples as a caution and a warning. So here they are. They need to overcome. And the way to cope? Don't be afraid. Do you know, I think one of the reasons why Revelation is a good book to be in is because we all know what the end is. We win. But we need to overcome. And the way to get through very difficult times here is to reorient our thinking to a Christ who is looking forward to returning and will be with him forever. When I get to talking about people who are struggling in life, who want to kind of just throw their faith aside, I say, you've got to put this in context. If you lived to be 100, even 120, I said, that's just a blip compared to eternity. I said, what would you want to throw it overboard for? Well, God never answered my prayer. I understand how we can get there, but the call is to persevere. The call is to follow our Lord. So as a believer, what kind of persecution do you face? Maybe we're not vocal enough about our faith. But let me suggest something that might be a little more, not quite so obvious. God says, stand up for me in the face of ridicule and disapproval. Don't laugh at dirty jokes. Stop trying to fit in. Isn't it really difficult when you're sitting around a group of people at your place of work who are probably not Christian people, and the jokes are going, you almost want to laugh because it would be impolite not to, and yet you would offend Christ. And so he says, in the face of whatever it is you're facing, that little bit of persecution that you feel, stay strong. The Christian life is a journey. Paul encourages us to run the race in a way that we will win. Some of us see, depending on your theology, and I know we don't all agree, and that's fine, but some of us see salvation as a vertical line. Here, I'm not saved. But if I pray a prayer, here, I'm saved, and it's all done. But I don't see the scriptures teaching that at all. Paul says, I run the race. Jesus said, I am the way. He said, there is a narrow road and a broad road. It's a journey. And it's fraught with all kinds of obstacles. And we need to run it accurately by trusting our Lord. That's how we get there safely, walking every day with him. So, I believe, and I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but, oh my goodness, this better be Jesus.
I know it.
It is not Jesus. But you can answer this person for me so they're not texting back. Where was I? Persecution. I think it's coming. Do you see how things are eroding? We're losing our speech, our chance to talk. there are so many things that are happening. And I hope it, you know, but my sense is, give it 20 years. And I think we're right on the cusp of it. So cherish your freedom, walk with Jesus, and be an overcomer now. Because when the time comes, and you may need to give your life, we don't know. But he'll give you the grace to walk through that. So let's bow for prayer. And the first thing we're going to do is just the same thing we did last night. What has God said to you? What has he spoken to you about? And then the second thing is we're going to break into groups tonight, and we're going to pray for the persecuted church. We're going to pray for maybe you know of people in your sphere of influence who are struggling at a place of work where there are unbelievers, and they're feeling persecuted. They're struggling to share their faith. They're maybe ostracized. We can pray for them. But let's focus on where we are right now and then where we are in terms of persecution and the church at large. So let's just take a few minutes to ourselves.